Another thing that I avoid in my free time is taking decisions. My wife hates that because I don't want to ask questions, to respond to requests. So where we can go to dinner, I said, whatever you want. I don't want to choose it. I don't want to give an advice or where to go.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, we've got Niccolò Scoditti from Hybris Corporate Finance. And initially, Niccolò had a pre-call where we discussed how he helped a client to something called a direct listing. And we're going to dig into that, what it is and why you might want to consider one for your business, or maybe you were not, but you want to know more about it. Surprisingly, not necessarily for the money, as you might have thought, there's other reasons. But Niccolò has the privilege of distinction of being the most prepared guest that I've had on the show so far, sending me great notes in advance. So if this pays off and you think interview goes better than the norm, let me know. And then maybe I just need to up my preparation game and we'll do that for you, dear listener. Niccolò, thank you very much for coming along. Why don't you break the ice by telling us something about you that not many people know?
Hi, James. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. Something people may not know about me is, you know, it's easy to imagine that given my job, I work fast with tight deadlines, but not many people know that to balance this, I enjoy activities and hobbies that involve working slowly, even passively, such as collecting vinyls and listening to them, or Lego assembling, because I like activities in my free time that allows me to take my time, progress gradually without pressure, where I can leave unfinished things. I love low intensity activities because for me are perfect for unwind. So in my free time, I want to escape the pressure and enjoying being patient.
That makes sense. My aunt does payroll, or she's retired now, but she used to do payroll for thousands of people every week. A job I would be terrified me. She did jigsaws. That was her thing, you know, like to come off the... And it's funny because she was a very calm person, but I always thought of her doing all this payroll. And like, imagine I do payroll for 20 people. Yeah. And it's a nightmare, you know, never mind thousands. So
yes, another thing that I avoid in my free time is taking decisions. And this, my wife hates that because, you know, I don't want to ask questions, to respond to requests. So where we can go to dinner, I said, whatever you want. I don't want to choose it. I don't want to give an advice or where to go.
Yeah, I'm also the same there. I wonder if I find this decisions fatiguing. Like it's like a muscle. I just don't want to do it. And I even hate changing my mind. If we make a stupid decision about a restaurant or something, I'll sit there eating the terrible food rather than my wife's like, why are we doing this? Let's just change. And I'm like, no, I don't want to change. Let's stick to that.
Yeah. No turnarounds, please. It's good.
I can empathize with that. And then also reminds me of, I have a friend of my parents who, you know, he was the CEO of Pernod, which is a large drinks company, a massive drinks company. And we would go to their house and, you know, his wife would just be bossing him around the place, like, you know, like telling him what to do, get the sandwiches and stop doing this and stop doing this. And in the meantime, he had thousands of people working for him. So there you go. That's the way it goes for me. All right. So let's talk about Hybris first before we get into direct listing, because you have a very interesting case study, which not everyone has had experience to. But let's get a sense of your background. Maybe you could tell us a bit about Hybris, the firm, and how it's structured.
Yeah, Hybris Corporate Finance, or HCF, it's an Italian firm, first of all. We operate mainly in our domestic market and is structured across specialized service lines, including M&A advisory, CFO services and advisory. And every service line has a dedicated team. So our CFO services business unit covers the financial planning and analysis, accounting optimization, and strategic financial leadership to, you know, support the long-term growth of our clients and to allow our clients to make data-driven decisions. We have roughly 20 professionals working for the firm, We even have a legal business unit. And, you know, our ideal client is growth-focused scale-up that is seeking strategic financial advisory to scale operations or to raise capital, or a struggling company that needs strategic advisory because they want option to start a turnaround, or shareholders who want to seek a financial partner to boost the growth or to sell the business entirely. We operate through three offices. One is in Bari, in the southern Italy, where I am now. We have an office in Milan, and we have a branch in the Emirates too.
Okay. And your personal role within that, are you normally developing clients? Are you working with clients? What's your sort of position there?
You know, I'm a co-founder of the firm that was founded in 2013. And since I serve as the global coordinator, so my day-to-day activities basically involve coordinating the business development and the workflow of the firm. And I do it jointly with my business partner, that is Virgilio Picca, another experienced professional. But I also, of course, work directly on the operational aspects of clients I am personally staffed with. Because, you know, our clients expect from us to oversee their financial division comprehensively. So our main activities are monitoring P&L KPIs or budgeting or treasury management. We have to ensure, you know, a robust economic performance of our clients. And this is our daily challenge. And my main work is to get it happen, coordinating all the teams that are staffed on our clients. It's not easy because we have, in the CFO services, we have 9 professionals that work in a fractional way. So it's basically Tetris, you know.
Right. Okay. So is this when you say it's a fractional, are they full-time with Hybris or are they?
Yes, they are full-time with Hybris, and we staff our team in a fractional way to all our clients depending on their need. So the workflow it's really challenging to manage.
I have this challenge as well. Sometimes I think, well, should I be working here? Should I be doing? It feels like as CEO, business development is always the thing I should be doing, you know? And then I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's got to be hiring. That's the most important thing I should be doing. And then well, actually, you know, I'm getting out of touch with customers. I don't know what they're doing anymore. And maybe that's the thing I should be doing. So I struggle with this. I'm not really sure how to solve it. What's your approach? Do you block off days? Do you eyeball it? How do you decide?
We try to be flexible, you know, because in the CFO services, in a fractional way, you know, the engagements are long-term engagements, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, depending on the project of the scope of work. And so in this great amount of time, the needs of our client could change. So the main challenge for us is, you know, our client has this due diligence because he's doing a deal, he's buying a company, and so he needs a greater effort from us. And so we need to further staff the project. We need more days a week to dedicate from our existing team. We have to involve more people on the team. We can't change the team because, you know, all the know-how from the previous month is an asset for us on the company. So we try to be, I think the modularity is the secret. You know, we know from our experience to reach certain objectives, we need that time. Okay.
Right.
Based on the dimension of the company, based on the sector in which they operate, based on our experience. The challenge is when we originate a project in a new sector where we have no experience. So this is...
Yeah, okay. So, that's interesting. Because you mentioned there, you know, you have quite an Italian flavor of customers, I would say, from grapes to furniture and some non-Italian maybe software. So maybe just give some flavor of the size of some of these companies and what you do for them.
Okay. So we work mainly in the lower mid-market. So our client is a company that operates and has a revenue range from 10 to 100 million, basically, because this is what our clients are mainly in the southern Italy. And in this particular geographic area, there are smaller companies compared to the northern Italy. And the average turnover of our clients is 20 million. And in the last few years, we worked on several interesting deals. We worked on a turnaround business plan for a leading Italian private security group. And this was one of one of the main projects that we worked on. It was in 2017, and it was that particular group had more than 3,000 employees with 40 million revenues. So it was a very challenging project. We work, as you mentioned, for an Italian grape producer that needed a turnaround. It was a 15 million turnover company. And we managed with the shareholders an M&A deal. We managed debt restructuring, and we could get for the company by banks new bank facilities to managing a corporate turnaround. That was the project we were working on. We worked too in healthcare sector, and this was a turnaround too. For this particular client, we rescheduled the debt exposure that was roughly 50 million. And so we managed the sale of non-strategic assets and a long-term write-off of long-term financial debt and commercial debt. So these were hard negotiation in this particular deal. And one of the last deals that we have closed is the direct listing on the professional segment of the Euronext Grow Milan market of a company that operates developing software solutions for e-commerce. Great. And this was interesting for us because it was the first direct listing in Italy.
Very good. Okay, we'll get on to that in a second. But just given the flavor there, it just a question popped into my mind, which is people don't seek out a fractional CFO when things are great, by the sounds of your examples there, like when everything's super and there's loads of profit and, you know, they've no work to do, etc. So is that common? Is that your experience that people come to you when actually things aren't great and they've been forced to your door per se? Yeah, is that the common thread?
Yeah. You know, based on our experience, entrepreneurs call us when things go wrong.
When
they have a problem to solve.
Yeah.
But we work for a lot of companies that are growing, that are scale up. But in that case, investors of the company tells the management to structure a finance department. And so to structure a finance department, they invoke firms like ours to complete the architect of the department, and then they staff it.
Okay.
So this is what they are experimenting.
Okay.
But
so
I agree with you.
Yeah, so there's two buckets there. There's either something's, so you might think, well, I want to go and find great clients that are doing fantastic. Maybe if you're a fractional CFO, look for the ones that things aren't going great for. Maybe actually they're a better prospect. And then I guess private equity firms are a good source because they're the ones who earn by. When you say investors, do you mean private equity or could that just be venture capital or?
Mostly venture capital, because right. Private equity inject sufficient resources in the company to staff directly, or maybe they bring their own management from there because they have a wide network. In venture capital, the investment is a smaller size, so there's more space from us. Usually we work with private equity in our M&A department as a counterpart or as a client when we assist the private equity, you know, in an exit of an investment.
Okay. And on the VC side, these are true VCs, not just angels, I guess. So you're a step beyond that. This is a Series B or a C. You're becoming involved.
Yeah, you know, in Italy, the VC market is still quite small, quite tiny compared to, you know, the American, for instance. Mm-hmm. So the average round of investment is about 200K to half a million. Yeah. It's enough money to bring the initial traction of the company and structuring it. But, you know, founders are still very careful on the resources and they need a way to have the maximum result with, you know, a minimal effort. And we have a space there because this is what we offer, basically. And the other thing is that if it doesn't work, you can change your strategy. It's not like internalizing a CFO with all the full cost and the business doesn't work, and all the risks.
Okay. All right. Well, I said I'd only ask you one question, but let me cheat a little bit because you've made me curious now again, which is I don't like cultural stereotypes, but I think sometimes mm-hmm. countries paint themselves in their own stereotype.
I
tell people, you know, if I go abroad, people say, if I was English, you'd expect me to be well-spoken. If I was German, you'd expect me to be smart. But because I'm Irish, I just need to tell a joke and have a beer and everyone's happy, you know? So in terms of the business community in Italy and the VC scene there, you compared it to America. Is it conservative? Is it, you know, how would they characterize themselves? Because Italy has had some tech successes and some breakout successes and obviously has a huge industry, very significant economy. But when it comes to VC, what do people tell themselves about what the environment is like there?
I think that VC, this new, you know, startup movement is helping Italy to change, because historically, Italian businesses are family businesses.
Yeah,
it's very linked. The major manufacturing Italian company was Fiat now, and the family of the founder still expressed the president of an international conglomerate between Italy and France. And many of our clients in a later stage of development are family business. Even if they are a 50 million company, you have, you know, the cousin in the sales and the uncle in the finance department. Okay. But with a startup, when you have to seek the founder, the co-founder, you know, this is not only because of the VC. This is mainly because of the venture studios that we have here in Italy you can count them on the finger of your hand, the impact, you can measure it. And so you found a company with other people that brings other values different than yours. And this, I think, could boost the growth.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Okay. Well, that's fascinating, but I don't want to distract from the main show here, which is this direct listing experience that you've had, which is, I've heard of the words, but I never really knew what they meant. So maybe we could just start us off with the client that you were dealing with and, you know, what is a direct listing to start off with?
Okay, so our client was a company named Yachio S.p.A. And as I said before, the company is, because it's active, obviously, but it operates in the, you know, MarTech, so the marketing technology tools to serve the marketing area, the marketing departments of our companies, especially in the e-commerce. So what is that? It's something that allows companies to become publicly traded without issuing new shares or raising additional capital. It's like become public without raising capital. So it's a deal. It's an operation that could be of interest of a certain type of companies that have certain needs.
Yeah.
Okay. Here in Italy, the Euronext Grow Milan has a specific segment of the market dedicated to these deals. That is the professional segment. And this segment allows company to access to capital markets without all the complexity of a complete IPO. So it's like a streamlined process to small and medium enterprises mainly that are seeking growing out in awareness, maintaining operational control, because there's no dilution, there's no raise of capital,
there's no money. Okay, which
money. What the company gains is that, of course, the awareness and the credibility boost of being public in a listed market. And what the shareholders of the company that do it that gains is that their shares gains liquidity.
Yeah.
The company is not a private company anymore. The shares could be traded freely in a regulated market.
Okay, so all right. So this makes sense to me suddenly. So let me break it down. So you go, obviously an exchange is just a company, basically, and they charge a fee for being on their exchange, and there's a bunch of paperwork, due diligence they have to do before they allow you in, because they can't allow terrible companies in, because they would damage their reputation. So typically, most exchanges, it's about $500,000 in fees, is it, to get listed? How much? So it's quite a significant payment just to get in, right? However, once you're in, I guess, instead of doing some sort of private market secondary for people who are maybe employees who have shares or partial owners who want to get some liquidity, they don't raise money for the company, but they privately, the shareholders can gain liquidity for their own stake.
Yeah, basically the shares are traded by direct transaction between buyers and sellers, but in a regulated market and at a known valuation. And the company's valuation is moving and is linked to the value of the single transaction that are made directly on the pro segments, on this pro segment. So, of course, you have the cost of doing that, but it's like an intermediate step brings to a complete IPO.
Okay, so let me ask a controversial question here. So this sounds like it's really for the benefit of the shareholders, not so much really the company, and yet the company pays for it. Is that a controversial statement?
You know, The company has a lot of benefits too, because they enter in a network of the listed companies, so they have a lot of opportunities, even business opportunities.
Yeah.
You build the trust to your investors. If you are in a journey of growth, like Yakio was, you gain a lot of awareness, because every 3 months you release, every update of your intermediate results becomes automatically a press release.
Yeah.
And so you build, it's like you're building your complete IPO from the inside of the market, benefiting the all the publicity.
Okay, so I understand.
Which leads you to maximize the benefit of the IPO.
Okay, interesting. So, I mean, it'd be great. I mean, maybe someday the crypto exchanges will allow small companies like me to, I guess that's what people are doing with tokens, right? They're tokenizing their business and trying to gain liquidity that way. But this is a more traditional established way of doing it. Okay, so maybe you could just in there, so I understand briefly what it is, though. So tell us about the Yaku story. What scale were they at, and how did it happen?
Yeah, the direct listing was completed in December 2023. Revenues that year totaled 6.5 million with 1.1 million EBITDA. The company at that time had over 5 million in cash, and which led to opting for a direct listing. This was mainly because the company raised capital before the direct listing, because the company was founded in 2016, and in the following years they went through an acceleration program and then a seed round, in which the Italian venture capital El Venture does lead investor, and then a crowdfunding on the Italian crowdfunding portal Mama Crowd. So Yakio raised accumulated 1.1 million and its cap table counted over 100 shareholders. So this is, this was another pillar, the direct listing.
Yeah. Can I ask there, so you said they had a lot of cash in the balance sheet. I understand, okay, they had the money to spend on doing this, which wasn't cheap. But why, is there another reason why having so much cash on the balance sheet would lead you to do a direct listing?
Yeah, they had a lot of cash, you know, on the balance sheet at the day of the direct listing. But the interesting thing is that originally the management plan was to go public with a classic IPO, mainly for two things. One is that for further fundraising was needing to increase the boost of the growth, mainly with two strategies. One was the acquisition of other companies, you know, competitor or companies that could grant synergies with Yakio. And the other pillar was the international expansion, implementing new warehouses in USA and Europe. And additionally, of course, the founders aim to gain, as I mentioned before, brand awareness and market visibility by leveraging the credibility of being listed.
So what I heard there was, well, if they did do a raise, the market would have said, well, you already have 5 million on the balance sheet. You clearly can't use that to grow your business. So why do you want my business and my money? Is that it?
It's, you know, in the business plan, the assumption was that we could use, Yakio would use all the cash and the additional liquidity raised to further boost their growth. Okay, so the founders were actually, they were seeking for fundraising before the IPO, and they opt for a direct listing because of the particular situation, that particular conjuncture, if I can say that, we were living at the end of, in the all 2023 year, you know, with the raise of interest rates that, you know, drained equity from the market. Okay. And so was much more difficult compared to the previous year to raise money. The median valuations of companies like Yakio deflated. So basically, the founders opted to split the benefits of a complete IPO in two different moments.
Yeah. Okay.
So they went for a direct listing to boost their credibility and to give to all their shareholders, that were a lot, much more liquidity of the shares.
Okay.
And postponing the fundraising in a later stage, in a second moment.
Okay. So it was a market timing thing. It wasn't right. They wouldn't, the market wouldn't have correctly valued what they believed the company had the potential to be at that time. At the same time, they wanted to get liquidity. I will say I'm a little bit dubious about this credibility thing a little bit, because sure, it helps, but is it really worth spending half a million for that? I think it's worth spending half a million if I can liquidate my shares, for sure. So is it public record that the investors used that opportunity to sell because if some of their shareholding, did the founders sell any of their shareholding?
Or the founder, no, they didn't sell, but I know the share is moving. And another thing, you talk about the cost of the transaction, and I am agree with you, but in another thing was at the time that we opted for a direct listing, that is in 2023, the Italian government offered companies going public tax credit on IPOs transaction costs. So what we didn't know at the time if that incentive would have been renewed for the following year or not.
Yeah.
And so Iacchio's management wasn't eager to miss that opportunity because they had at that time already completed the entire process and accounted for all the related costs.
Okay. All right. There you go, Bingo. So this is the sort of thing that a fractional CFO will be aware of, these opportunities in a particular market, right? So you hire a fractional CFO from Ireland, he was not going to know about that tax break for Italian companies listing, probably not. And this is the market awareness that a fractional firm brings you. And I guess when you see, you've got experience to all these different companies, you get to spread that experience across all of them. It's very interesting.
Of course, you maximize the value you grant to your client if you have, local experience of the market and if you know the sector in which your client operates.
Yeah.
This is another thing that we are struggling now.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Very interesting case. So, and what part of the deal were you doing, the preparation of the listing, or were you doing due diligence, or how was your role here?
Yeah, we were one of the Iacchio's financial advisors. So our engagement included drafting all the company's business documents, such as the information memorandum, the business plan, and the book of assumption of the business plan. And all these documents, of course, was presented to Italian Stock Exchange and to potential investors. It was hard work because there were a lot of reviews. It was a six-month engagement. We worked hard on it. We know that we have been involved in a crucial milestone for Iacchio and in something that in Italy was never did before. If listing is quite common, maybe in America, the famous, if I can say, example of a company that I'm listing is Spotify in 2018.
Right.
And it was mainly for the same reasons to build trust because you are controlled in a regulated market. You grant much more liquidity of your shares to your shareholding. And you have sufficient cash to finance your development, your growth. Another thing for Iacchio, it was that the company was growing a lot. And so the management correctly, because now 1 year passed and it did go that way. 18 months, 2 years later, the company have stronger fundamentals in terms of P&L and in terms of balance sheet, so in terms of valuation.
Yeah, okay. I guess then when you're open, you open now. There's a certain benefit to being private because your valuation can remain mark to market. And then suddenly now there's no hiding, out there. So it's really on your performance straight up, which is why it's more attractive investment. So it's a trade-off.
Of course. And you do it for the fundraising, but you basically do it because with the crowdfunding, when you have 150 shareholders that are private people, it's like that you have to report to them every 3 months with your performance.
Yeah.
Now with direct listing, it's no much difference for the company.
And if I were to ask the founder today, would he do it again? Do you think it was a success? No doubt.
I think they will do it again because I know that several business opportunities was provided from the network because the service they provide to companies can be of interest of a lot of other listed companies in the EGM market. So being in that network is like being in a pool of prospects for the company.
Very good. All right. So I guess my last question on this then is how much of the process was managing the investor? Because you're working for the company, I get that. But it sounds like to me, there was quite a bit of keep bringing the investors along with this. Were they nervous about this? What did you have to do?
Yeah, there was a lot of preparation because, of course, we made all the data set we built. We drafted all the data set. But then there was the roadshow. And the founders of the company had a lot of preparation in presenting the company to investors and presenting between the business plan and the assumption beside the business plan to investors. So this was a lot of work and a lot of prep meetings. And was a challenge.
Very good. All right. Well, this is a great case study. I love a case study which has meat on the bones. You can tell specifically what it's about. So maybe we'll just wrap it a little bit and tell us, before I ask my last question, how can people get in touch with Hybris, or who should get in touch, more importantly?
Okay. So we have, of course, our website where who is interested in our firm could get in touch with us and could be informed about all our different activities, and other thing very important in our business, could take a look of all our track records of clients and deals that we worked on in the last few years. And our website works very well because we have then the team page where every one of the professionals involved in the company has a personal page and could be contacted directly by email from whoever is interested. So what I would say is come visit our website and see what we work on. And if you're interested or if you think you could need our assistance, let's write directly on the website.
Okay, so it's chriscf.it is the website. Yeah. We'll link that up in the show notes. So great, Nicolo. So maybe here comes the question everybody dreads when I ask this question, is like, do you have a business hero and why?
You know, I consider my business hero one very famous in Italy entrepreneur, and his name was Adriano Olivetti. Don't know if you know him, but he had a visionary approach to entrepreneurship, you know, because he like blended industrial innovation with a profound sense of social responsibility. This is common nowadays to say something like that, but we are talking about the 60s and the 70s. So in Italy, Adriano Olivetti is pure legacy, and its legacy goes beyond his corporate success, because it's like it emphasizes an holistic model where business growth, employee well-being, and community development are all interconnected with each other.
It sounds very Italian, a dolce vita, very appropriate, I guess, yeah. Very good. I love the story. So, okay, well, thanks very much, Nicolo. And thank you very much for listening to the podcast this far. Your special reward for being so diligent and staying with us is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/CFO Mastermind. What I've done is I've gathered up all the guests from the last year, and we've started meeting monthly in a mastermind. What's a mastermind? We put you in a group with four other in a breakout room online. You bring a business challenge that you want to get some feedback on, and then your peers can give you their thoughts on that. So it might be developing your practice, might be a client challenge, whatever, and you can have a chat about it. Takes about an hour. You get 10 minutes on your problem, and I had very good feedback on it. So go to procurementexpress.com/CFO Mastermind if you're interested in signing up for that. Thanks. You've been a great guest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. It was a pleasure for me.